You're listening to iWine Radio.
Hi, my name is John Terlato from Terlato Wine Group, and I am part of a family that enjoys and is passionate about wines and winemaking. You can find out more about the wines that we represent and make at terlatowines.com. Enjoy.
Welcome to Wine and Dine. My name is Lynn Crelo Chamberlain, host. You're listening to iWine Radio.
Joining us this week on iWine Radio is John A. Terlato, who is an attorney and vice chairman of Terlato Wines International and the Terlato Wine Group. And today we're going in, you know, coming into the fourth quarter here. We're in the fourth quarter, and people are making their plans for what wines to give as gifts and to serve at their holiday meals and all the corporate parties. The topic is authentic wines versus engineered wines, and who would not really rather have authentic wines? I mean, you could have a party, an office party, with that theme. We are authentic in what our service or product is. Wines that tell a story of the region. And boy, you could really, John, have a parallel like that. It just occurred to me as I'm talking here. You know, people who are trying to promote their American made, or at least their product or their service that's speaking of who they are and their area, and be serving Terlato Chardonnay, Terlato Pinot Noir, and Sanford Chardonnay and Pinot Noir at their events.
You know, it's a rich topic, Lynn. There's lots to talk about here, and you know, I'll tell you, as a family, we've been very, very fortunate over our 70 years in the wine business. You know, going back to a time when, you know, most wines that were being sold were Sherry Port and Muscatel, you know, 39 cents a gallon. My grandfather, Terlato, and my father were, at that time, selling the great Burgundy and Burgundies and Bordeaux that the world had to offer. And along the way, along those 70 years, we've met and befriended a lot of fantastic winemaking families from around the world. And when we finally came to the moment where we, again, fortunate to be able to purchase wineries in Napa, Sonoma, and Santa Barbara in Australia, we were able to take some of those learnings from along the way and apply them to our winemaking and our grape growing at the vineyards that we own. And one of the things that struck me as I was kind of, it's actually an interesting story. Would you like me to share kind of how I came to some of these conclusions?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, please.
Okay, so we purchased Sanford Winery in 2002, and Sanford Winery in Santa Barbara was the Sanford and Benedict Vineyard was actually the first vineyard that was planted in Santa Barbara County. It's really the vineyard that launched the wine business and the grape growing business in Santa Barbara County. And so now we have this amazing piece of property that's planted to Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And in fact, interesting in and of itself, because it was planted on its own rootstock. And there's a very, very small percentage of wines in California that are planted to Vitis vinifera, to their own rootstock. So we started with vines that were incredible. And we'll discuss that in a couple of minutes about how that affects flavor. And so as I was now, you know, chatting with my father and my brother about Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, I thought, gosh, you know, probably a good idea to see what other people are doing in terms of farming and grape growing and winemaking as it relates to Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And that actually took me to Burgundy. I was less interested in knowing what the neighbors were doing and more interested in knowing what the great Chardonnay and Pinot Noir producers of the world were thinking about at their wineries. And so I started to bring wines home to taste with my brother and father, and these what I would refer to as discoveries. And every time I would bring home a bottle or two or three or six, and I would open them at our table with my father and my father would start to talk about having sold those wines back in the 50s and 60s when he had befriended Frank Schoonmaker and Alexis Lachine. And I'm thinking to myself, gosh, this is incredible. how is it possible that these families that have been making Chardonnay for, and Pinot Noir for many, many generations have maintained their relevance? These wines were important in the 50s and 60s, and they're still beautiful and important today. What are they thinking and what are they doing that allowed them to maintain their relevance? And as I started to spend time in Burgundy, what I realized was it was all around the farming, around farming grapes that told the tale of the place. These were not winemakers as scientists or chemists. These were grape farmers. And in fact, the more time I spent in Burgundy and the more time I spent in our own vineyards, I realized that probably 95%, if not more, of what affects the flavor profile of a wine is as a result of farming, not necessarily winemaking science or chemistry.
How old were you when you were doing this research and doing all this critical thinking?
Well, started in 2002, 2005. So I'm at that point I was 45 years old, 50 years old ish, and with enough knowledge and experience to know that this required some exploration. And I love learning. I love experimentation and learning and trying new things. And 15 years ago, if you would have asked me, give me the split in terms of the end product, farming versus winemaking, I probably would have said 80-20. 80% farming and 20% winemaking. And today, my feeling is 95% farming, 5% winemaking, if not more.
Isn't that amazing? I just love it.
It's incredible, right? And so this is where I started to develop this idea and this thought around wines that tell the tale of a place, authentic, what I would refer to as an authentic wine, mm-hmm. versus those that are engineered. Now, mind you, that does not mean that wines that are engineered to a certain flavor profile are inauthentic. It just means that they are bent or engineered or forged into a shape to hit a certain flavor profile. And there's nothing wrong with that. I would argue that the winemakers and the wine companies that are designing their wines to hit a flavor profile are probably 1,000 times smarter than we are, because they're selling a lot of bottles. And they are absolutely positively appealing to a specific flavor profile and a specific consumer, and it works. But when I looked at what we had in terms of these vineyards, I thought, well, if you look at the great Burgundies, the great the Bordeaux, the great wines from Italy, the great wines from Spain, any, old world winemaking region, what sets them apart is the nature of the land that they own and farm. And Michel Chapoutier did a brilliant job of showing the variables and the variances from vineyard to vineyard when, 15 years ago he did a project where he basically took Syrah grapes from specific vineyards, his selection parcellaires in fact, and he vinified them exactly the same, and they all taste different. They all have idiosyncrasies. And this is what really highlights how soil affects flavor profile. And this is, in fact, the idea of single vineyard wines in California.
And John, with Michel Chapoutier, was the water factor the same? No irrigation? It was just whatever Mother Nature provided and
right.
How far down the roots went? Okay.
Precisely right. So he was farming the place. And we all know today, those of us vintners and grape farmers know that, the soil is made up of certain nutrients and minerals, and the vine picks up those nutrients and minerals and delivers them through the vine stalk by way of sap and into the clusters, and provides us with some idiosyncrasy that is directly tied to the place. And so I was thinking, well, gosh, if we have these amazing vineyards and incredible soil and we farm them intelligently and sustainably, And we work to extract from the land that those the best qualities that it has to offer and bring those grapes into the winery. They're kind of fully formed, or at least they should be, if we farmed them thoughtfully and intelligently. And then it's really the responsibility of the winemaker to be very, very detail-oriented, but at the same time be non-interventionist in taking those grapes from berries to a wine. And the idea is work along the way to make sure that the winery is clean, the processes are correct, paying very close attention to the details, but let's not interfere with telling the tale of the place by trying to add or subtract things to that wine to change the flavor profile. This is what I'm speaking about when I'm talking about wines that tell the tale of a place.
Yes.
Now, if we go through that whole process and we farm intelligently and we've got the right varietals or what we think are the correct varietals planted to the right soil and we bring them into the winery and we treat them carefully and in a very non-interventionist way and we don't like what we have at the end of that, I would argue that we should probably go find another vineyard as opposed to try and bend it and engineer it into a flavor profile.
If your objective is, in fact, to be the shepherd of crafting.
Of the land.
Yes.
Right.
Because,
it's
like
goal.
You said, there are some people who, I mean, that's not their goal. Their business model is not based on that. It is to create wines that are good wines that maybe fit within the profile of whatever they've set out, but they're not really honest wines in a way of telling a story of where they come from.
And I'm also very, very careful. I'm never critical of other people's wines. Because let's face it, there are, you know, millions and millions of wine consumers out there, and there are, you know, hundreds if not thousands of wineries. And the goal is to connect up the consumer with the winery. And it's really the consumer that decides what they like and what they enjoy and which wines they will purchase, repurchase, and share at their table. And so I'm never, ever critical of other people's winemaking style or techniques, because there's such a broad variety of consumers who are looking for certain things. And our job as vintners and winemakers is to provide wines to the consumer that appeal to them and maybe even moves them. And that could be a wine that has been directed to a certain flavor profile, or it could be a wine that tells the tale of the place.
Yeah.
Now, what I will say, you know, as I'm kind of looking ahead, and I've learned this from my father, and my brother and I both subscribe to this idea, you know, if you think about the great and important wines of the world, they're capable of transcending generations. And in fact, of the 100 oldest businesses in the world, 10 of them are wineries.
Holy moly.
Now, this is an incredible fact, right? This is an amazing fact. So the wine industry in and of itself lends itself to multi-generational ownership, and if you look at every single one of those 10 wineries, plus the next 50 or 60 or 100 or 250, pick a number, that would be considered to be the great and important wines of the world, they're, you know, usually involves a family that has a vision. They own vineyards, and their vision is connected to what the vineyard can offer them and can provide. There's a brilliant winemaker involved. And then the wines are delicious when they're young and they're age-worthy, right? Those are the common threads from my perspective.
Yes.
That exist between and amongst the great and important wines of the world. Remembering, this is just one man's opinion, so please, you know, stop me if you feel like it wouldn't be, you know, interesting or appealing conversation, but it's my belief that it's the land and the intelligent farming of the land that allows wines to transcend generations, because it's telling the tale of a place.
What is, you've mentioned the word vintner, you've mentioned the word grape farmer, or the phrase grape farmer, and then everybody knows the word winemaker, but share with listeners, please, in France, in Burgundy, where you are about to head off to, they don't call it a winemaker. The reference always goes back to the land.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And so, share with people what is the word? What are the words, and what do they mean?
Well, one could be a winery owner and a winemaker, and that I suspect that person would also be referred to as a vintner. One could be a winery owner and a vineyard owner, but not technically a winemaker. That would also suggest a vintner. And in fact, you know that many of the domain owners in Burgundy are, in fact, the farmer, yeah. the vineyard owner,
yeah.
and the winemaker.
Yes, yes.
I would think that's a pretty good descriptor of a vintner.
And in French, they would say vigneron.
Precisely. But a vigneron could be anybody that's
working
attached.
With.
Yeah, working with the land, working in the vineyards. A vigneron could be a person that works the land or owns the land or some combination of that, but they might not necessarily be, quote-unquote, a winemaker.
Yes, yes.
A winemaker is a very specific descriptor with a very specific definition. And again, it's the winemakers that are brilliant are a joy to be with because they truly understand that it's their job to interpret the soil and the land and the vineyard and the varietal.
Okay, now let me ask you, let's flip this on the other side from the winemaker and vintner to the consumer. How does a consumer, somebody listening to this conversation who really has not thought about this before and is amazed that there is so much academic thought that goes into this, how do they approach a bottle, a glass in front of them of Terlato Chardonnay or Sanford Pinot Noir in the glass? And to me, the first thing that I think most people do not do is be an active listener and an active participant and be patient. They just want to start drinking.
Boy, what a great question. This might be another topic in and of itself, because it's a great question. So, and again, I'll share with you my view. I think wine drinkers come into a space with a couple of ideas or thoughts in mind. One could be just pleasure, right? I'm going to open a bottle of wine and I'm going to pour it into a glass and put it on my table with food, or maybe just have it, before dinner, or share it with friends or some combination of those things. And their goal is just to open a bottle of wine and enjoy it without, a great deal of I don't want to say a great deal of thought, but I'll just say with the goal of enjoying that glass of wine in mind, and that, by the way, is brilliant. I love that idea because wine should be, in my mind, enjoyed that way. It shouldn't really require a lot of thought. And one of the comments that we make all the time is, delicious does not require an explanation.
Yes. Oh, good.
Right?
Yes,
so,
okay.
Kind of like a cheeseburger. You go into a restaurant and you bite into a cheeseburger or you a piece of fish, and you have a consumer might have an almost instantaneous visceral response saying, boy, this is delicious. This is amazing. This is the best cheeseburger I've ever eaten. Or they might say, this is good, but, it's just okay. It's not the best one I've eaten, but it's not the worst one that I've put in my mouth. Or they might say, oh, this is not really good. I don't particularly care for this. So the consumer already has the fundamental ability to decide on their own what they like and what they enjoy. And at the very front end of wine drinking and wine consumption, I believe, is this idea of just enjoying wine for the sheer pleasure of what wine has to offer. Right?
Okay. I'm right with you on that.
We're good, right? So that, I think that's the starting point, and I do believe that that's the starting point should be that simple.
Yes.
I want to open a bottle of wine, I want to taste it, I want to enjoy it, and then maybe I'll share it with other people because I enjoyed the way that it tasted. So then there's a moment where the consumer might be intrigued with a wine and the way that it tastes, and at that point they might actually want to start to understand why that wine tastes the way that it tastes. And they now kind of go, I refer to it as going down the rabbit's hole. It's not really, but now they go on this journey. They start their journey to try and understand, why did I like this? And then they might even try another wine and may like it or not like it or note the differences. And that's the moment where I suggest to wine consumers that they start to taste varietals side by side. Taste different wines of the same varietal side by side to see how they differ. And in fact, this is how we do our tastings amongst my father and my brother and I, our family and our team members, to try and understand how wines differ one from the next, and tasting them next to each other is a pretty good way to do that. In fact, you could taste water that way, bottled water, and note the differences. But if you just taste a glass of water in and of itself without anything next to it as a reference point, you really wouldn't be able to note the differences, would you?
Yes.
So a bottle of Badois is going to taste different from a bottle of San Pellegrino sparkling water, I can guarantee you, because the mineral content on San Pellegrino is much higher. And that mineral content is going to affect the flavor, and the consumer, it really, truly would be able to tell the difference. My belief is that they would be able to tell the difference. And the same holds true for wine. So wine drinker steps into the box. They open a bottle of wine to enjoy it. They poke their head up and say, gosh, this is fantastic. There must be more to this. I'm now going to launch myself onto some journey or exploration around other types of Chardonnay or other types of Pinot Noir. And then the next level of exploration is to identify why those wines might taste different based on the vineyards, based on the farming, based on the winemaking techniques. And they start to dig into that, and this is where wine becomes an absolutely fascinating topic.
I don't know if you know, I moved to the West Coast. I'm living in Prosser, Washington. And a couple days ago, I had a conversation with a 35-year vineyard worker at a Washington State Grape Society trade show. And this gentleman made a comment that, to me, is very fascinating, which I want to explore here in at Yakima Valley Community College, and that is that before he went through an education program for Spanish-speaking vineyard workers and learned a tremendous amount and kind of went up the ladder as a result. And he said during that training, for the first time in his life, he was actually doing tastings and comparative tastings. And it finally occurred to him that the work he was doing in the vineyard, and he was specifically responsible for all irrigation, all water in the vineyard, including overhead water to protect against frost, and that every introduction of water affected the wine. And so the light bulb went off for him, and he made this connection. And I think that there's this gap between not just people who are working in the fields doing the physical labor, but for a lot of consumers that are just drinking something that's a specific price point or a specific taste profile, that they have not put together this connection. There's a disconnect between all the work that goes on in the vineyard and what's in the glass and the appreciation of that. It's not just 12 or 13 or 14% alcohol. It's a tremendous amount of work and risk and long-term investment.
Well, so yes, I agree with the fundamental premise, and I agree with the, you know, eureka moment that this vineyard worker might have come to. You know, in fact, the great winemaking families of the world, they're either the vintner, the winemaker, the family member, or some combination of those three, spends a lot of time in the vineyard. And the vineyard sends signals to us about health and well-being of the vine, the predictability or the consistency of ripening of grapes, the when one might introduce water or not introduce water. You know, the introduction of water for irrigation is very different from the introduction of water to protect against frost. Those are two very different purposes.
Yes.
One is One is to grow, to help to foster growth, and the other is to protect the fruit. And yes, at the end of the day, it will affect the quality of the wine at some level. So if you have potential frost in the vineyard or oncoming frost in the vineyard and you don't introduce water to protect against frost, you may freeze your grapes, and that's going to affect the quality. There's no question about it. The introduction of water by way of irrigation is either designed to increase, well, it's designed to do a bunch of things, but at its fundamental level, it's designed to maybe increase rate of growth or increase tonnage or take some stress off of the vine. Maybe the vine has been stressed a little bit too much and not getting enough water, and there's a moment where you could go from stressing a vine where it's producing great fruit to the point where you're stressing a vine to the point where it won't produce any fruit.
Or yes, yeah.
It'll die potentially.
Yes.
That's extreme, but you know, we deficit farm at our wineries because vines, generally speaking, do well when they're under stress. In fact, that's when they likely produce the highest quality fruit, is when they're a little bit stressed out and they're kind of searching for water and they're getting the right kinds of nutrients that they need and they're dealing with, you know, heat and photosynthesis, but there's a little bit of a deficit in terms of the amount of water that they would like to have. And it's in that scenario where we believe that vines produce a very, very high quality of grapes. And so we don't want our vines to be what might be referred to as overwatered.
Yes, yeah.
We don't want them to be kind of fat and happy.
Right.
We want them to be just, you know, under a little bit of stress, right? And that makes them stronger, we believe. But you can't stress them to the point where they're not healthy.
John, let me ask you, as vineyard owner and vintners in California, how are you seeing the drought situation affecting the grapes that came in this past, you know, month or two, 3 months?
Yeah, so there, you know, this is very site specific. So the drought issue in California is absolutely positively important, a concern, one that we're paying very, very close attention to. And I know, by the way, that the neighbors in California, whether it's in Napa, Sonoma, or Santa Barbara, are concerned about water. They're paying attention to water. They're utilizing a number of means and devices and tactics and strategies to conserve water. And it is of concern. I think the drought situation at this point, you know, we have a lack of what I would refer to as surface water. But we're not yet, you know, in dire straits as it relates to groundwater. But we still have to pay very, very close attention to this because the groundwater has to recharge. Because if we keep depleting the groundwater source, we'll eventually end up in a really, really bad place.
Okay.
And so many, if not all, of the winemaking families that we're connected to and know are paying very, very close attention to the drought and the effects of the drought, and managing our water very, very carefully. I actually just did a piece in the Wall Street Journal. They were asking a bunch of questions about the drought and how it's affecting us and how people are responding to it. And again, it's a very, very serious issue that needs to be tended to and attended to. And I can tell you that the winemaking community is paying very close attention to the drought. Mm. So that said, we had a fairly small harvest in 15 in Napa. I think, you know, that's just what Mother Nature delivered to us this year. I don't want to directly connect the dots between a lack of water and a smaller crop because
okay.
there's many other things that affect that.
Yes, okay.
That cause that. But we ended up with a smaller crop this year, but very, very high quality of fruit, very high intensity of flavor because there were less clusters on the vine, and it was small. They were smaller bunches. So we've got fruit that has ripened phenolically and come to the right sugar ripeness at the same time. And we think we're going to have a very, very good vintage in 15.
Good.
So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, you answered it as best you could, and I appreciate that. I put you on the spot with that.
No, we're very concerned about water. I told you the 62 different things that we've been doing for 22 years, and paying very, very close attention to water. It's everything. It's not just irrigation. It's how you treat the water in the winery. It's how you use water. It's everything.
Yeah.
It's a thought process and a philosophy more than just being tactical.
Right.
We have to conserve water the world has to conserve water. It's not just Napa grape farmers that need to be concerned about conserving water.
You know, I don't want to go off on this tangent, but just to throw in here, when we're going into the holiday season, sometimes people have a tendency to overindulge, especially for those who don't normally, there's always that possibility. But as you're describing how one maintains and cares for a vine, an individual vine, let alone a vineyard, it's almost it really is the same sort of philosophy as how one approaches their own personal health.
Mm-hmm. Everything in moderation. I mean, all of life. I think enjoying life is a good thing, and there are plenty of wonderful things that life offers us by way of food and beverage and relationships and you name it. Moderation is key. There's moments where we're gonna enjoy a little bit more of something, and then we go back to moderating the enjoyment of it thereafter. That's my view, but again, that's just one man's view. So, I know I couldn't, eat and drink every day, every week, every month, at the level of a crescendo. Otherwise, wouldn't be very healthy.
Yes.
So I'm trying to be careful about that. Everybody, I think that's good advice for everyone.
So let's start with the whites and compare the Sanford Chardonnay, Santa Rita Hills Appellation 2012 that's currently available to the Terlato Family Vineyards 2013 Chardonnay that's from Russian River Valley Appellation, Sonoma County. They're two totally different wines.
Yes, they are. And so this is really where this comparative tasting opportunity arises. So these are two wines that are vinified in very similar fashion, but they taste completely different. And I would argue that the Terlato Family Vineyard Chardonnay is more earthy and minerally and flinty and has kind of earthy and minerally notes to it, and that the Russian Santa Barbara Santa Rita Hills Sanford Chardonnay is a little bit more citric has some citric notes to it. I don't think either one of them are the kind of oaky butterscotchy vanilla version that has become very, very popular.
You don't like that. I mean, that's not something that you aim for anyway, as I've heard you say in the past.
Yeah, I'm not hugely fond of that style. And again, as a vintner and vineyard owner, I guess we get to choose, what types of wines we would like to farm for. We're blessed, by the way, in our Santa Barbara vineyard, Santa Rita Hills vineyard, and in our Russian River vineyards to have soil that can deliver a citric note version in Santa Barbara and a earthy, minerally flinty version in Russian River. And so that's really what the soil is providing. The soil is providing us with the opportunity to make wines like that or to farm our grapes to end up there. And what we're trying to do is not interfere in the winemaking process to push them in the direction of oaky vanilla butterscotch, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And the reason that we're doing this is, A, because those happen to be the types of wines that we enjoy and that we like to drink, but B, I also think that those wines go very, very well with food. So the Terlato Chardonnay and the Sanford Chardonnay are really designed to exist on the table with food. in you know, what we refer to as, you know, one of the vignettes of life, right? A bunch of people sitting around a table with food and wine and family and friends, you know, talking hopefully about a bunch of interesting topics, not just sex, politics, and religion, right? And maybe not even necessarily in that order, but this is, right? This is, I mean, you throw the political, discussion bomb on the table, and you're off to the races, right? So our view is that we have these amazing vineyards. We're capable of making wines that are telling the tale of the place. The Cholato family vineyards, Russian River vineyard, provides us with this foundation of minerality and flinty and earthiness, and that's what we're trying to highlight in that wine in a very subtle and supple way. And so our barrel regimen is designed not to have oak overtake the beautiful minerality and earthiness that the vineyard has to offer. The same holds true for Sanford. We have vineyards that are providing us with some citric notes in our wines, and we don't want to mask what the vineyard is providing to us. But here you have two Chardonnays, both from California, both with different flavor profiles, and I would argue that they taste differently because of the fundamental underlying soil that we have in each of those two vineyards, which are very, very different.
Okay, how about the Sanford Pinot Noir? The Santa Rita Hills Appellation, also 2012, and the Terlato Family Vineyards 2012 Pinot Noir, also from Russian River Valley Appellation, Sonoma County. Now, again, very, very different wines. Same variety, different appellations, same year, but totally different wines.
That's precisely true, and this is where I encourage wine consumers and friends to go buy, purchase, put on their table different versions of a specific varietal, a like varietal, Pinot Noir in this case, and taste the difference between the two places. But you have to also know at that point, you have to be aware of the fact that the winemakers or the winery owners or the vintners that are connected to those wineries whose wines you're tasting subscribe to this philosophy of farming for wines that tell the tale of the place. The Terlato Pinot Noir from Russian River and the Sanford Pinot Noir from Santa Rita Hills are both designed to tell the tale of the place, and those are two wines that I put on the table all the time next to each other. And then I'll also include a Burgundy.
Oh, right? Yeah, okay.
Right, so I'm like, okay, so here's, you know, two California wines and maybe a Burgundy or two, and they go into the glasses without anybody knowing which bottle is in which glass. We taste them blind.
Oh, good, yes.
Right? And I ask people, I say, look, just start by kind of assessing whether or not you like the four wines that are in front of you. Which one is your favorite? Your favorite, just from a pleasure perspective, which is the version that you happen to enjoy from a flavor perspective, right? So make note of that. And, you know, I give them a little piece of paper and a pencil or a pen, and they note which is their favorite, or they'll rank them 1 through 4, their most favorite to maybe their least favorite. And then what I'll do is introduce food. Right, so we've got these four wines in front of us, we're sitting at the table, and now I will introduce food to the comparative tasting, and I'll ask them to now revisit which is their most favorite, trying to show them how food and food and wine pairing affects their perception of the wines that they have in front of them. And now we're off to the races. Right?
That's when it really, really gets interesting.
No question, right? And I'll purposefully, you know, I might purposefully put a piece of salmon with a barbecue sauce on top, or a piece of salmon that's just very simply, you know, grilled or sautéed with salt and pepper and olive oil to highlight a specific wine. And it's just a fun, it's
exercise.
A fun event.
And people could be doing this at, you know, when they're gathered with family and friends, people tend to get together more so over the through the end of the year. But Instead of talking about politics, it's probably a lot safer to talk about wines.
Well, it could be.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if wine is as much of a divisive topic these days as politics, but certainly, you know, if I can direct the conversation towards food and wine, we are, in fact, off to the races. And people say to me, well, God, this was so much fun. This was so interesting. I learned so much. You know, how could I do this, you know, at home? I mean, I feel like I don't have the knowledge or the experience to do what you just did. And I said, in fact, that's not really accurate. You do possess what you need to do what I just did, to replicate this in your own home, because really, truly, all you need to know is what you like. That's it, right? The first version, wines alone, you tasted them, you ranked them, and you identified which one you happened to like the most. Then we introduced food, and you just replicated the process, but we've added one more element to the analysis and one more element to be considered, which is food, and that may have changed which wine you happen to like. But it's the same process, and anybody can do it. It's the easiest thing in the world. And in trying to demystify wine, which I believe to be one of my responsibilities as a vintner, is to demystify wine and make it easy for people, I encourage them to do this on their own because they possess the skills to do it without having somebody hold their hand. All they need to do is have somebody show them one version of it, and then they can go and they can replicate this themselves in their own homes.
Yes. But I suggest that people plan ahead for this, because if you want to be doing this with the wines that we're talking about today, the Sanford Pinot Noir Chardonnay and the Terlato Family Vineyards Pinot Noir Chardonnay, they might not be able to get that at their local wine shop or grocery store, and they should plan ahead and either have them special ordered or direct buy them from the winery.
Precisely. And there's just a couple of elements that I think they need to attend to just to make sure that it's a fair comparison. So first is the four glasses on the table, they should be identical, right? They should be the same shape and size. So we're not introducing yet another element, because shape and size of the glass does affect the way one perceives that wine. So four glasses that are identical. Second is the wine should all be served at exactly the same temperature.
Okay, good.
So that there's no variation in temperature, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if they can, you know, hopefully there's no other elements in the room that might get in the way of what they smell and what they taste. And I suppose the most extreme example of that would be something like incense, right?
Oh, no, not even that. We're talking people, men's cologne and women's perfume. That is a major detractor.
It can be a distraction, right? But that's kind of a little harder to manage. You don't want to make, you know, a wine dinner fussy. Or feel like we're being, you know, dictatorial or a draconian, like, you know, don't wear any cologne or don't wear any perfume. But right, I mean, it could affect how people perceive the wine. But it should be fun. At the end of the day, it should be fun and it should be easy. You put four glasses, four wines, all served at the same temperature. Introduce food and just let people talk, and they're going to have different opinions. That's the fun part. But it should be easy and fun. Mm. Not fussy.
Not fussy.
Not fussy.
You know, some people are fussy, but I agree with you. It should is the key word. So John, tell us, please, where should people, direct people where to go online to learn more and even possibly purchase the Sanford wines and the Terlato Family Vineyard wines?
Okay, terrific. So the Sanford wines, super easy. The Sanford Winery website, right? Type in Google Sanford Winery, and there's a, you know, veritable cornucopia of wines that we're making at Sanford. Single vineyard wines, founders vines, the wines that are available in the broad market. But they definitely can find our Sanford wines on the Sanford Winery website.
Okay.
So that's an easy one.
Okay.
Terlato Family Vineyards, same way. You could go to Terlato Family Vineyards or Terlato Vineyards, and you will see wines that are available on that website. There's also another website that you could go to, which is called Uncorked uncorked.com. Uncorked.com is a website that has many, if not all, of these wines that we just spoke of. And they can all be kind of packed up together and shipped to somebody's house.
Oh,
and,
okay.
It's an easy path to getting to securing some of the different wines that we're making as a family, because it is, you know, we have Rutherford Hill, we have Chimney Rock, we have Sanford, Terlato Family Vineyards, and then our joint venture in Australia with Michel Chapoutier, which is called Domaine Terlato Chapoutier, which is Syrah based wines being made in Australia, in Western Australia. So uncorked.com would be a place where you could certainly find some of these wines.
Okay.
It's not all of them.
Okay. I think this would be a really nice gift to somebody, is the gift of an evening, a gift of a theme of what to do. You know, send them the link to this interview and the wines, and maybe even have it catered or something.
Yeah, possible. I mean, again, keeping it simple. One of my favorite evenings in my home is cooking cheeseburgers and serving up, you know, Pinot Noirs, Burgundy in California, kind of put the wines out or put the glasses out and let everybody have a fun time without a lot of fussiness, as I had mentioned.
Boy, I recently discovered steelhead trout, which I never had on the East Coast. And so when I was looking, it was the only thing that was not frozen, because I wanted to have things that are fresh, not frozen. And it looked like salmon, and it was spectacular with Pinot Noir.
It is. It absolutely, steelhead trout is delicious, and it is spectacular with Pinot Noir. I agree with you. That's a great combination. And then we can also tinker with different preparations of it that might affect the flavor of the wine.
As you said, like a salt, pepper, olive oil versus like a barbecue sauce. I mean, how different can you get?
Yeah, precisely. It's a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun for me. I'm always encouraging people to tinker around with wines and with foods and putting them together. It's just a fun exercise.
John A. Terlato, Vice Chairman of Terlato Wines International, has been our guest today, and we have been talking about authentic wines versus engineered wines, wines that tell a story of the region. Thank you so very much for your time.
Lynn, I thank you. It's just really a pleasure to be able to share some of the things that our family has been doing and continues to do in the wine space, in our vineyards, and in crafting wines from a particular place. I love sharing the topic. I love sharing the wines, and you are always so gracious in providing me with an opportunity to do that with your listeners. So thank you very, very much for the opportunity to share what we're doing in our vineyards.
You're listening to iWine Radio, first in wine talk. I'm Lynn Crelo-Chamberlain.